I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is David Kelly, co-founder of IDEO, a global design firm that takes a human-centered approach to innovation. IDEO has helped innovate products, including Apple's first mouse in 1980, the first stand-up toothpaste for Procter & Gamble, surgical tools for Medtronic, and furniture for Steelcase. But IDEO also works with governments and social organizations to help transform education systems and deliver social services. David is the founder of the Stanford D School, also known as the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design, which emphasizes a multidisciplinary, human-centered approach to innovation. He is the co-author with his brother Tom of Creative Confidence. The book describes a process that helps people realize their creative potential. Welcome.
Thanks.
When you're in a Boeing 747 and you see the lavatory occupied light, how do you feel?
I remember those days. You know, Boeing was my first job out of college. I was in a group called the Passenger Payloads Group. So anything that's inside of the airplane, you know, the stowage bins and the carpets and the seats and that. And so my responsibility was in lights and signs, so the panels along the side or the lavatory occupied sign.
And your life has taken a different course, and you help other companies innovate. But do you have like a reflective moment when you are in an airplane thinking, this is where it all started for me professionally?
I always loved planes as a kid. If you were a kind of an electrical mechanical engineer like I was, or a kid interested in mechanisms and things that move, the plane was the kind of most complex thing you could think of. So, yeah, I am sitting there kind of with a better understanding of why it's staying up in the air, I suppose, than the average person. And that feels good. I have no fear of flying based on, you know, kind of the understanding of the plane.
You grew up in Ohio. You were one of four children.
Yes.
Your father was an engineer at Goodyear,
yes,
the tire company.
Yes.
Your mother was a housewife. What were some examples of engineering or inventive activities that you did around the house?
I was obsessed with kind of taking things apart and seeing how they work. So, you know, the radio didn't work in the car, and I'd take it apart. And sometimes when you put it back together, it actually worked. Bicycles were the vehicle of choice for a 12-year-old, right? And so I would take my bike apart and sandblast it and paint it a different color, or, you know, weld two bicycles together for a tandem long before tandems existed. But, as a kid, my life was more like if something didn't work, we didn't call the repairman. You know, we fix it ourselves.
There's a story of you inventing a telephone for a girlfriend. Can you explain that?
Sure. I've always made gifts for everybody my whole life. You know, I've never bought a card or rarely bought a gift in the store. I usually make things for people. And this particular girl I was trying to win over, I really wanted her to only call me. And so I took a phone and I took it apart and took all the buttons apart and took all the guts out of it and replaced the guts so that, if you can think of it as all the buttons end up pushing the redial button with my number on it underneath. You can't see that. It looks like a normal phone. But any button is really just completely wired directly to the redial button, which I've programmed my phone number on. And so no matter what button she pushed, it called me.
So here you are, an inventive youth. You played in a rock band, and your first job was at Boeing, which you did not like. How come?
Well, you know, I'm not sure you want, like, a creative 22-year-old changing the way the plane flies, you know what I mean, like, or taking risk. And the excitement for a person like me is to come up with an idea that's new to the world. That was not offered as a young engineer working for Boeing, and so it seemed mundane. And, you know, I'm like a kid right out of Carnegie Mellon, you know, trying to do something exciting.
And luckily, Stanford at the time, this is in the mid-1970s,
yes,
had a program, a design program, that you heard about as you were carpooling one day.
Yeah, yes.
Can you explain how you initially found out about it? Because
sure.
In a way, it was sort of a pivot moment for your life.
Stanford was the pivot moment in my life, absolutely, joining Stanford. So it was funny. So I'm working at Boeing, and it's 1973, and it's the gas crisis. I don't know if people who remember 1973, we were standing in lines, and you could only get gas on every other day. And I'm sitting in, and so I put up a sign that said, hey, you know, would somebody like to carpool with me? And this guy named Bill Potts answered the note, and we started driving together. And he's still one of my best friends today since 1973. And he had just come from Stanford, and he had been in this program. And so as we're driving, he kept saying, "You got to go to Stanford. It's perfect for you. It's just perfect for you." And I said, "You know, you don't know how bad my grades are. You know, I can't get into Stanford and stuff." Anyway, to make a long story short, he eventually badgered me to the point that I applied. So he was really right. I got to Stanford, and that was in 75, and I haven't left.
What did design thinking look like when you were a student?
Yeah, so Stanford really was the kind of ground zero for what we call design thinking today. I mean, there's design, you know, which is kind of was in art schools, which was kind of about aesthetics. What should something look like, especially something new, you know? You know, what's a laptop look like if you've never seen a laptop before, right? And so it is magical, and that's why we love certain chairs and we love certain flower pots. But that wasn't Stanford design. And then there was kind of engineering design, which was, you know, how do you design this rocket so that it gets to the moon? That's engineering design, right? And Stanford was kind of right in the middle, the kind of combination of kind of art and engineering and kind of, you know, user interaction. You know, how do you interact with a door handle, or how do you? And so the aesthetics were present, and the engineering issues were present, and the human issues were present in this Stanford program, started in 1958, actually. And so when I got there, I wasn't the deepest engineer in the room, right? I wasn't as technical as some of my colleagues, and that made me not as viable in certain jobs. And I wasn't as artistic as some of my friends who had gone to the art schools, right? But this kind of the synthesizing of those things was a perfect fit for me, and that's what the Stanford program was about at the time. So it didn't really belong in any of the Stanford product design program. Really didn't fit in any of the kind of industries that already existed, industrial design or engineering design. It was its own thing. And so I'm glad I found it, you know, because it was the right fit for me.
You found it and you've perpetuated it, taking a more human-focused view on the design process.
So, yeah, so that's the crux. If you had to say, okay, what's the one thing about what we do at Stanford and what we do at IDEO, it's this tendency, this being human-centered as a way to be innovative. Most places are, they either have invented a technology and they're trying to see whether humans will like it, or they have a business idea and then they try to see if humans will adapt to it. We do it backwards to that. Our approach is we go in and try to understand what people value, what's meaningful to people in a certain area, and then we'll try to invent the other thing.
So, and what's an example?
Examples of that might be improve the experience of taking the train from San Francisco to Palo Alto. And so they'll go in and they'll look at the whole customer journey. They'll look at finding out about when the train runs, about getting to the train, about standing on the platform, about boarding the train, about sitting on the train, about food on the train, about using your thing, and all these little dots in that journey. And then they'll try to figure out how to be make each one of those dots extraordinary. Whatever it is that we do, even medical devices, or we look at it from a human perspective and then try to figure out how to make it really fit, how it will delight the person who's going to use it.
Another example is the Embrace Infant Warmer. Yes. Can you describe how that came to be?
In the case of Embrace, is a group of students who were looking at this notion of incubators, because there's so many babies die because of low birth weight in poor developing countries. What they looked at was, how we can make a low-cost incubator, because an incubator costs like $2,000. And as they went, our methodology does what we call a bias towards action. Just jump right in. So they go to Nepal, they go to where the babies are, they go to where the hospitals are, and they find out that the incubators are empty. And the reason is the babies are out in the bush. They're out in the villages. They're not near the hospitals, and they can't get to the hospitals. So they have this idea that what they'll do is they'll make this kind of, basically think of it as sleeping bag for babies. And so instead of costing $2,000, it costs like $20, right? And they can distribute them to the doctors, and all these low birth weight babies can be kept warm, and then they have a chance to live.
What's interesting about this, as an example, is being out there in the field really gives you firsthand exposure to things that you could not come up with in the office. For example, they discovered that you shouldn't just say on the instructions, heat to 37 degrees Celsius, because women have a bias. They see Western medicine as aggressive.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, maybe not 37, maybe 35. And so instead, the students in your class just had an okay signal when it was warm enough.
You know, when it got to, okay, this is the kind of thing you learn in our process week about being iterative and building prototypes. Rather than kind of trying to make it perfect, we just build one. I mean, the normal process, unfortunately, in a lot of companies is to, like, have all the smart people sit around a table and talk about it. You can't imagine what the real issues are. And so not only do we jump in quickly and start building things, but we iterate.
You allude to Yoda from Star Wars, where he says, do or do not, there is no try. That resonated with me. Just get pen to paper. Just put the prototype out.
Yes, we call it bias towards action. Jump in. A crummy first draft is much better than procrastinating. Then it's a simple a matter of editing it. So if you build a crummy prototype, which is quicker and you get it out, first you get information back quicker. But the other thing is people are willing to help you more with a crummy prototype, right? If you build this beautiful, shiny, glowing thing, people say, ooh, I don't like it, but I better not say anything because, you know, it's done. But if it's this crummy thing made out of cardboard with some glue on it, like stuck on it, they say, oh, I got an idea. You should do this. You should improve this way. And so then the question for success is only how many of those iterations can you get in? How many times can you build a new idea, show it to people, all the stakeholders, and then have them help you, and then do it again and do it again? That's the key.
Related to this is an example you give in your book of making ceramic pots. A teacher told half his class to make as many ceramic pots as they wanted, and the other half to put all their energy into making one best pot. Turns out the students who focused on quantity or lots of iterations rather than quality ironically made better pots.
If you say to somebody, well, I'm only going to judge you on how wonderful the one pot is that you do versus make as many pots as you can, focus on the quantity. And the study showed that focusing on the process and on quantity results in a much better pot, lots of much better pot.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is David Kelly, co-founder of IDEO. We'll hear more from David coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is David Kelly, co-founder of IDEO, a global design firm that takes a human-centered approach to innovation. IDEO works with companies, governments, and social organizations to help innovate products, education, transportation systems, among others. David is also the founder of Stanford's Design School, or the D School, which emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to innovation. He's the co-author with his brother Tom of Creative Confidence. The book teaches a process called guided mastery, which unlocks the creative potential in anyone, even those who thought they were not creative to begin with. We're talking about prototypes.
Yes.
And Steve Jobs was a big user of prototypes, incidentally.
Yes.
And the reason I bring him up is he was one of your first clients.
He was.
How did you come to meet him?
Yeah, he's probably one of our most important client. I met him because Apple was just getting started and my little company was just getting started. And I walked down one day and talked to a guy named Jerry Manick, who was the person who he wasn't inside of Apple, but he was a little bit ahead of me at Stanford. He had designed the Apple II, which was the first computer. He was there, and I started talking to him. He said, oh, I need help at Apple. And we met Steve Jobs, and then, you know, we just started designing stuff.
He's important professionally to you, and also he introduced you to your wife.
Yeah. Steve and I were kind of bachelors at the same time and kind of enjoyed hanging out a bit. He got married. I think it bothered him that I wasn't married. So one time he called me and said, it was Thanksgiving, and he said, I found the girl for you. And I said, Steve, you know, I trust you about, you know, like circuits and, you know, computers, but I don't trust you. You're no Yentai. I don't trust you about women. And he said, no, no, I got the right girl for you. You know, how he's so positive about everything, you know, and he had no lack of confidence. So I said, I had a meeting in Sacramento. I said, I can't come. And then the meeting got canceled in Sacramento. And so he, I said, I call him. I said, are you still, you know, can I still come to Thanksgiving dinner? And I went, and I met my wife, and I met my future wife, Casey, there. And so Jobs, in addition to being kind of my most important client in the history of the company, he's probably also one of the most important people to me. And we had a long friendship. He helped me with the D-School. He's, you know, any kind of big decision, I always knew he'd be. You know how when you have friends and you're afraid they might not tell you the truth because they don't want to hurt your feelings?
Hmm.
That was not the case here.
Going back to your professional life, why was he your most important client, other than his visibility was so vast and Apple is, you know, larger than life, that other clients came to you?
The most important thing he did for us was he had this way of doing everything with intention. I mean, like how you put it in the box was not an afterthought after you were done. Right. And what color it was or how it felt when the person touched it. At the time, companies were concerned about the engineering or the software, the hardware part of it. And the other stuff was just incidental. And he was not that way. And so not only did he do everything with intention, but he set a standard that was beyond what you thought you could do. So I think for us and for every designer that's worked for him since then, they've all done their best work for him because he was so demanding. And he took you to a place where you didn't think you could even go. And we continued doing that. Even when we weren't working for Steve anymore, we had that in our, it was our habit to work in that way.
I want to go back to the very early days of IDEO.
Yes.
Basically, when you were 26 years old, it wasn't called that at the time. It was called HK Design because your co-founder was Dean Hovey.
Yes.
What was the mission for the company then?
The mission for the company was to enjoy being with your friends. At Boeing and at National Cashier, I worked before, it was kind of hard for me. I didn't know anything. I was used to like having a good time with my friends in the summers. So I got to work and I said, ooh, this is, you know, 12 months a year with, you know, like people I don't know. When I had the chance to start the company, I had just gone through the Stanford program. And so I thought of myself as having these special skills and that other people might want them. So I'd go to see companies. It was hilarious. So I'd go to see companies. And I'd go to see a furniture company. And I'd be in there with the CEO. And I'd say, we'd like to design a new chair for you, sir. And he'd be asking questions like, what experience have you had designing chairs? And I didn't have the guts to say, not only haven't designed chairs, we haven't designed anything. But what I said was, we have this process. We have this process, and I'll bet you it'll result in a different chair than the people who know, have deep knowledge of designing chairs. Our chair will be different, and maybe, you know, it'll surprise you, and it built from there.
What are other examples of important clients for you in the early days, aside from Apple?
There were lots of them. The first client we had was a reading machine for blind people. It was called Telesensory Systems. It was a thing where you put your hand in it and it raised the letters underneath, like with the little kind of needles, like, you know, those pin art things where you put your face in them and it pushes the pins around. You know, we did bicycles and, you know, movie special effects and, you know, like whatever. I mean, because our thing's about a process, right? We're not experts. I mean, we've gained expertise in certain areas, but especially at that time, we were only experts at the process, not experts at any particular industry.
Another person who has been influential on your career is Professor Albert Bandura. He's a Stanford psychologist.
Yeah.
And he has this notion of guided mastery, which you've demonstrated in your book, for example, with a snake phobia.
Yeah.
Can you explain briefly what that is and how you apply it to design?
Albert Bandura is a famous psychologist. We just kind of discovered him, and I went and saw him in his office one day, and he's kind of like the world's expert on self-efficacy, which is very related to creative confidence, which is he defines it as you have a sense of the world and that you can accomplish what you set out to do, that you feel like that. That's self-efficacy. What we found is that we've been using guided mastery to get for people to get over this kind of fear of failure or fear of being judged, right? Whereas he was using guided mastery in all kinds of areas, including phobias, and that's what I found really interesting. So he'd have these patients who had a fear of, like, snakes or spiders their whole lives, and they weren't going outside or they weren't going on hikes because they might run into a snake. And so the way he got them out of that, and he had nearly 100% cure rate in a few hours, he uses guided mastery, where he holds their hand and he takes them through a series of successes with respect to the snake. He, you know, you see the snake in the other room and it doesn't bother you. You see a friend with the snake. You look through a two-way mirror. You stand in an open door. I mean, you put a glove on. And it turns out we've been doing that with clients and companies, and we've been doing it with students for years, which is they think of themselves as only analytical. We put them in teams. And then what we do is we do small projects with them, and they succeed at having a breakthrough idea in that small project. And then we make them a little more complex problem, you know, a little more complex. And each time they succeed. And by the end, they say, oh, my God, I'm creative. And they flip to this state of creative confidence where it changes their lives. I mean, I know I'm sounding a little like over the top, but it changes their life completely. And they, in their own personal life, they kind of take on more difficult challenges. They have more stick-to-itiveness. It's a change. Bandura finds the same thing with the people who have been cured of phobias.
How can you apply this approach to organizations you've worked with? Mm-hmm. Give a specific example.
Yes. So we use the same methodology, this guided mastery and this series of projects to help any culture be more creative. K-12 education is by far my favorite. We look at the San Francisco Unified School District and try to improve the experience that kids have at lunch, right? You go in there, you look at it, and you find out that lunch really isn't about food for kids. It's about the socialization of seeing their friends at lunch. Mm-hmm. So all you really have to do is have them have a great experience meeting their friends, and then you can throw in a healthy lunch, you know, and make a big impact on improving that experience.
Through these processes, you are empowering these organizations and these governments and these companies, giving them the confidence that they too are creative.
Yeah, the end result is that a government or a company or an individual ends up with this confidence in their creative ability. It's like if you're a writer being challenged with a blank piece of paper. Right, I mean, that's daunting, right? But if you have, if you're mindful of a creative process that you own, that's in your body, and somebody gives you a difficult problem, you don't hesitate. You say, I know how to do this.
How has your personal life changed as a result of being so empathetic and human-centered when it comes to helping organizations and companies with their products and services?
I think I can tell when I'm in a room with people, I think I have a better sense by being empathetic what they want. And then it's easier to make the compromise. Okay, I'll give them what they want, knowing what I want, right? It almost starts to feel like a sixth sense about what people care about. I mean, you know, it's the same as, you know, when you're driving and letting somebody in or letting somebody cut in line with you in Starbucks because they're late. One of the things we do at the D School is we check in before every meeting. We go around and everybody checks in. And they tell what's going on in their life so that I can treat them differently. I know if you're stressed because your mother's ill or your kid just went to the hospital in an accident, or this is your anniversary, I mean, I'm going to treat you differently because I know what's going on in your life. Rather than if you just start a business meeting, you kind of hold everybody to some neutral thing. Some people are having good days and some people are having bad days, or some people are really happy to be at this meeting, or some people wish they weren't there. The meeting's going to be different and we're going to treat each other different if we know that.
Maybe I should have done a check-in before this interview. What's going on in your life right now that I should know about that might provide context?
Well, I'm in New York, and I'm running around talking to lots of people, so it's not my normal day of I'm missing my classes to come to New York and talk about the book. You know, I don't like to miss classes. I want to be there for the students, and so I have that angst. But I'm thrilled that, you know, from a place where people thought of design as kind of after, you know, the kind of painting something the right color at the end or making sure that it's pretty, that now, you know, we are getting to be able to have a strategic role. There was an IBM survey that said the creative ability of their employees was their number one concern. We've moved from being at kind of at the kids' table to the main table, and that's why I'm very excited to be here and talk about this.
I want to talk a little bit about the founding of the D School. You're a professor at Stanford. You've been there since 1978, and you always kind of made fun of yourself because they wanted to find ways to give you a smaller office. What has changed in the ether in a way that you were able to convince the president, John Hennessy, to create a whole school around this?
Yes. So, you know, back when design was mostly in the art department or at Stanford, it was in this kind of lightweight engineering mode. It didn't fit in the model of the university of, like, depth and trying to win Nobel Prizes and all the other things that go on at a university. And it really wasn't central to the university. What happened, I believe, is that as problems got more complex and as new solutions needed to come up with that were not down the normal discipline path. They weren't deep in a narrow silo. The big ideas were coming in between the silos, and so something had to be done. So we started talking about T-shaped people. People had breadth and depth. And what happened was that we started to have some success. I was an engineering professor, so I always taught in just straight engineering classes, right? But, you know, after tenure and I had some flexibility, I started teaching with other professors who were just my friends. And we knew that the university, John Hennessy, is really big on multidisciplinary teaching. I would bring up a business school professor or a computer science professor, and we would teach, and their students would come with them. I started to see the students' eyes light up as we did this. And so we just said, I went to the university and said, look, we should codify this. I mean, I think this is a big deal. And we should start teaching and do this in a systematic way and have an institute where students would come from all around the university. And that eventually became the D School.
What's an example of big problems that you felt were falling in between the silos of these specialized fields?
Well, it's the big stuff. It's all, you know, it's like, you know, healthcare and transportation, sustainability, K-12. I mean, that's the stuff that we started working on. Those are the laboratories that eventually ended up at the D School.
Once you decided you wanted to institutionalize this, can you explain how you got the funding for it?
One day I was in the office of Hasso Plattner, who's one of the founders of SAP, the big German software company. And IDEA was doing a project for him, and we were kind of done with the business meeting. We were talking about things that we enjoyed doing, you know, and he was talking about sailing and Formula One racing and stuff he was involved with, which I was really interested in. And he said, you know, what are you interested in? And I said, well, I'm really interested in this multidisciplinary teaching thing that I've been dreaming of. And to make a long story short, he said, well, I'll help you with that. So I went back to Stanford, and when I got back to Stanford, I was telling this story, and the people at Stanford said, you know, when a billionaire says he's willing to help you, you should probably call him right back. So he funded the whole thing.
He put up $35 million.
First round, $35 million. I mean, he said to me the other day, he put his arm around me and said, you know, this is one of the most important things I've done in my life.
And needless to say, it's one of the most important things you've done in your life.
Yeah, probably, yeah, the most. I mean, it's affecting so many people. Seeing these kids in my office just, you know, after they've taken a couple of D-School classes and they're just emotionally so excited. You know, they always wanted to be a creative person. You've gotten into Stanford, but, you know, you feel kind of, you know, the...
Trapped.
Trapped, yeah. The one, that, like, ad agencies are the worst, right? They have this thing where they say there's the creatives and the non-creatives. Well, if you're in the non-creative group, how does that feel? These kids have been in the non-creative group. In a successful group, it's just a non-creative group, right? And so to add that tool, to add that muscle to your personality, this confidence in your creative ability, it's fun to be around these people. They're so happy. Oh, I'll tell you a little great story. So in one of the interviews we did in the book was with a Buddhist monk, a former Buddhist monk named Jinpa. And Jinpa is the translator for the Dalai Lama. He's on the Compassion Project at Stanford, where he's taking monks and putting them in the scanner and looking at what happens in their brain when they're in a state of compassion. We were talking to him about our book, Creative Confidence and stuff, and he said, you know, there's really not a word in the Tibetan language for creative. I said, so what's a word that's close? And he said, well, the closest word is natural, that basically you want to be more creative, be more natural, and that it's only a question of taking away the stuff that got in the way of that. You know, I love kindergartners, right? You go in and say to a kindergartner, how many of you are artists? How many are you creative? Everybody raises their hand. And refrigerators are full of pictures, you know, that their parents supporting them. And somewhere about fourth grade or age nine, we start valuing them, and they start getting the message that we're saying it, and they opt out of this creativity, and that's got to stop.
You've written a book with your brother, Tom Kelly, Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within Us All. And the catalyst for the book was your finding out, in a way, that you had throat cancer in 2007.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so in 2007, I was shocked. I was in my daughter's classroom, like helping the kids design new backpacks, you know, in the fourth grade. And I got a call from the doctor, and he said that the lump in my neck was not what they thought it was. It was cancer. And I struggled to complete the project with my daughter. And then I came home, and it was the bad kind, you know, 40% chance of survival. And so I struggled for quite a long time with the cancer, but I'm in remission. My brother was there for me every day. And so when we got done, we decided we'd do a project together. And we came up with this book as the way to do it.
Why do you think you are so close with your brother?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, it has a lot to do with my parents being so open. My parents were very kind of tolerant of things, you know, like I'd get a bicycle when I was 12 for Christmas, and on December the 26th, I'd take it down and sandblast it and paint it a different color. It was perfectly good red bicycle, but I wanted it to be a different color. They just felt it was okay for us to do stuff. So when we had a house that was too small, and so when one of my sisters was born, my brother and I moved to the basement. So I think we were, you know, out of sight, out of mind a bit. So picture you're two boys and you're in the basement and nobody's watching you, and you kind of have a good time.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
My guest has been David Kelly, co-founder of IDEO. Coming up, we'll meet Dan Yates, co-founder of OPower, a software company focused on energy efficiency. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of OPower, a software company focused on energy efficiency. OPower works with utilities to monitor how much energy a consumer uses and gives households and businesses incentives to lower their energy consumption. The idea is that through the use of behavioral science techniques such as peer pressure or peer proof, people will feel more compelled to act more responsibly, at least to keep up with their neighbors. Dan started OPower in 2007 with his Harvard College classmate Alex Lasky. The company is based in Arlington, Virginia. Prior to starting OPower, Dan launched EduSoft, a software company focused on public school assessments. EduSoft was sold for approximately $40 million to Houghton Mifflin in 2004. Dan is an avid hula hooper. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I heard you like giggle a little bit after hula hooper. Is that true?
I guess I'm a good hula hooper more than an avid hula hooper. It's become a running joke in the company after the first company picnic we had where there was a hula hoop contest that I nearly won but did not win.
Other than hula hooping at your company, can you describe what else you do at OPower? How does OPower work?
Well, is there anything else to do other than hula hoop?
You tell me.
Yeah, OPower is a software company. We work with utilities to help them transform the way they deliver information to their consumers. People just don't really know enough about their energy use, and they're not motivated in the way they could be if they had the right information. And if we could just give them the right info, we could change energy behavior. And so what we do is we use behavioral science techniques, and in doing so, we've shown that we really can substantially reduce consumption consistently and persistently. And on average, we drive about a 2% savings, which for an individual, not much.
What is that, like $40 a year or so?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for a utility, I mean, it's $160 million over our customer base per year.
And why are utilities caring to collaborate with you? Why do they have the incentive to decrease energy use? I know it has something to do with state-level compliance.
That's right.
But can you explain that further?
Legislators have decided, hey, there's a better way. Let's roll, instead of, you know, to meet demand, let's pass a standard that asks our utilities to run programs to help people save energy. And so then the utility puts forward a portfolio of programs, things like light bulb subsidies and OPower. And then what happens is they put a small tax on the bill. And the only programs they run are ones that actually save you more money than they cost. So the tax is always less than your savings. So the key thing is that utilities, with that tax, they get to recover any of the revenue they would have lost. So they're still made whole. So that way everybody, you know, everybody wins.
We're talking about incentives based on behavioral science techniques. What incentives are most powerful for people to reduce their consumption?
The most well-known of our of the techniques that we employ is the neighbor comparison. It's how we started. So the first product we brought to market was actually a mailed paper report, and we chose the mail because utilities don't have enough customer email addresses. It shows people how their energy use compares to their neighbors and then gives them targeted recommendations on how to save. But the peer proof is a very powerful tool, but it's one of many. Mm-hmm. So as an example, commitment is another very powerful behavioral science technique. Typically, customers who set a goal to save energy save over 8% a year. A third example is just rapid feedback.
You see a lot of this dynamic in other areas such as exercise, right? You give people instant feedback. They're setting their goals. There's the social pressure.
Absolutely.
Where else do you see this
happening?
I
think there's a whole trend now of the measured self. All of these different wristwatches that track your heartbeat and change, you know, how many steps you've taken, they're not doing anything to you other than giving you feedback. But what we measure is what we modify. So the behavioral science is more of a tool to grab the customer and engage them about themselves.
How are you using science behavioral techniques in your personal life? For example, like with you have a baby, you're married. Do you see yourself like constantly applying these techniques in other ways personally?
I've been accused anxiously in business cases situations of being an expert negotiator because people fear that I have some mastery of the behavioral science sphere that I must admit I don't think I have. Mm. But yeah, you can't help but think about these techniques.
In addition to the behavioral science component of the company, you also have a pretty robust data analytics feature. Can you describe that some more?
We can help people understand their usage in very easy, timely, and important to act on ways. As a simple example, we do a predictive high bill forecast. So we've all had that experience where you get that bill in the mail in the middle of winter, and it's $500 or $300, and it blows you away. Now, you get a call from us, like a fraud alert. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're 12 days into the month. You look like you're on track for a $300 bill. And what a relief, especially for a low-income customer.
They receive phone calls?
That's right. We do.
Are you the voice for these calls? Because you have that voice, or you're impersonating that voice quite well.
You have received a high bill. No. It's not me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of Opower and an energy efficiency company that partners with utility companies to reduce energy consumption. The utility companies pay Opower for its software and receives payments from the government as an incentive to encourage energy reduction. Now, when you first thought of founding this company, did you have this behavioral science in mind, or is it something that you arrived at after coming up with the idea?
Actually, the behavioral science component was one of the original pieces.
And you have a chief scientist. His name is Robert Cialdini. He's a social psychologist. How integral was he in the founding of the company?
Yeah, so the way we got started was we had a simple idea that there were a billion utility bills going out a year to Americans, and there was this huge missed opportunity to educate people about their energy use. But that was, and we knew there was energy efficiency funding out there, but it wasn't enough to start a business. And then we got lucky, and this is where the serendipity came in. We were introduced to the research of Robert Cialdini, who had just the year prior concluded a study with the Hewlett Foundation in San Francisco, or Palo Alto, rather, that showed conclusively that if you gave people information about their energy use relative to the average of similar-sized homes in the area, that they would reduce their consumption.
How were you introduced to him? By whom?
I was talking about, there's a lot of people, and I was waving my utility bill around at breakfast with this woman, Rhea Sue, who's the Hewlett Foundation, and her eyes went wide, and she said, "You won't believe this. We literally just got a research report on this very fact, you know, 2 weeks ago." And she scanned and sent me the studies. And then we reached out to Bob, and it's been, you know, that's the beginning of the story.
Could you explain the study that he did with the fans?
the study was to try and convince residential homeowners to make a simple, low-cost efficiency move of turning off their air conditioner and switching to a fan in the evening. And they did a door hanger campaign. And they put a door hanger on each door with four different messages. The first message simply said, it was a monetary message, you can save $50 every month if you do this. Second message was about the environment. You can help keep the skies clean for California if you do this. Third message was about preserving resources for the future and being a good citizen. And then they measured those first three against a control group, which received no message. And they saw no impact in consumption, as if they hadn't come. And this is, again, an expensive way to go about marketing. So they had a fourth group that got a message that simply said, in a recent survey of your neighbors, three-quarters of them say they turn off their AC and switch to a fan in the evening. Join your neighbors. With no justification for what the personal benefit was, the economic benefit, the environmental benefit, none of that. Just do what the rest of the folks are doing. And that group saw a 6% reduction in consumption.
Why were you and Alex focused on doing something in the energy arena? You had started a company in education, for example.
So I started an educational software company called EduSoft, and we sold the company, and I had the opportunity to take some time off. And I talked my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, into taking a year-long trip with me. We bought a Toyota 4Runner, we shipped it up to Alaska, and we drove the full Pan American Highway from tip to tip.
So from the Arctic Sea to Patagonia?
That's right.
How did you meet Toby?
We met at a wedding in Birmingham, Alabama.
So here you are on a road trip in Latin America, and what connective tissue is there to O-Power?
So we took this trip. Among other things, we were listening to books on iPod, and we had downloaded Jared Diamond's Collapse, which is really the story of human populations throughout time that have had ecological collapse, ranging from the Mayans to the inhabitants of Easter Island, and you know how through leadership collapse can be averted, and without it, you can have true catastrophic, you know, ecological degradation. And as we were driving the drive, it felt like I was watching the movie in real time accompanying this book.
What are examples of that?
When we were driving through Guatemala, we were driving across this large plain with cows and bucolic scene. And then we arrived at this outcropping of rock. And on top of this rock, probably a couple acres worth, was the densest rainforest you could think of. And it hit both of us that this huge plain we were driving through had historically been a rainforest. But when you see those things and you see how stark it is and you realize how much we have changed the earth, that's when it hits you.
Toby Whitman, you're now wife. You were still boyfriend and girlfriend on your Latin American trip. What is something surprising that she learned about you on that trip or not on that trip?
She thought I was going to propose when we got to the southern tip, and she hadn't talked to me about that expectation, and so I didn't do that, and that was a shocker. So I made it up to her. What I explained was that I felt odd proposing to her after being a year away from friends and family and feeling disconnected from them, which was just how I felt. I felt like in many ways proposing was more of a public thing than a private thing because I knew I wanted to marry her. Mm-hmm. So to make it up, I went and videoed all of her friends and our families, telling them that I was going to propose to her and asking them what they thought. And then I proposed by showing her this video of basically everyone else knowing before she knew, which was a lot of fun.
So here you are. You and Alex are starting O-Power. You both don't have a background in the energy industry. What were the first things that you did?
As we were just starting this, we were talking to some folks in Texas who told us that we just had to get down there and get involved with what was going on the legislative side. And there was a bill being introduced around energy efficiency. And we flew out with not even yet incorporated, but with a blow-up, you know, mock-up of our energy report, 2-foot by 3-foot foam core blow-up, marched around with no company, with no brand name, with not even business cards. We managed to meet with all of the key legislators, and we got legislation written into this bill that authorized the utilities to use this public efficiency funding for home energy reports. Now, never mind, there were a few dyes that we didn't dot and T's we didn't cross, and we weren't able to use that funding for years to come. But for us, it was this amazing realization that if we could move the needle that far with so little, that there was a real appetite for this.
Yeah, it was incredibly self-actualizing.
Yes. So then we said, okay, let's do this. And that's when we got serious. We raised some money. We incorporated the company, and we went out to, and we hired some people, and we went out to go sell utilities.
Do you have a story or an anecdote about your early meetings with some of these utilities?
Well, our first utility that we sold was the City of Sacramento SMUD, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. Allie Crawford, who was a program manager, had funding for a carbon calculator, which was tools to enter in the different parts of your energy use throughout your life and calculate your total carbon footprint. And we showed her what we were doing, and she just was fascinated by it and thought, if you can do my calculator and this, we can work together. And so we went back and in a 10-day period worked nights and weekends and built a carbon calculator.
Were there other utilities or other recollections of meetings with utilities who were not as amenable to what you were doing?
No, I mean, you can't succeed without hearing no 100 times.
Right. So what are examples of some of those?
Most of those are customers of ours now, so I don't have any great examples I want to share.
We talk about getting funding in the early days, and NEA in D.C. was one of your earliest investors, and there's a story of Harry Weller, I think he's a partner at NEA, hearing what you were doing, and he said, utilities give you data and they're paying you? How do we invest?
Yeah, so Harry had a very clear vision, which took me a long time to fully appreciate, that the real power in our business was that we were being put in a position with all of the utilities' energy data to be able to help them on a whole host of consumer-facing issues they had. And that the fact that they were entrusting us with their data put us in a phenomenally strategic place in the landscape. And then that they were paying us for that as opposed to us begging them for it was even more astonishing.
I want to talk about your upbringing, your early life. You grew up in San Diego. Your dad was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And your mom was a Hebrew school teacher.
That's right.
What did your dad do in the Air Force?
He was a pilot. He was an instructor pilot with a T-33 jet, and then turboprop. And then he flew C-130s for 10 years, which are those huge cargo planes.
Was he ever in action?
He was. He was in Vietnam. He flew air support in Zaire back when we thought that Mobutu was a good guy to back up, which is, you know, not his proudest day, but he was a good, you know, he was a good airman. After my dad left the military, he went into defense contracting. He worked for a couple different firms. We ended up moving to San Diego, where he worked at General Dynamics.
We always like to put a bow around, like, how our childhood influenced what we're doing now. But, like, what are certain elements of your youth that feature prominently for you?
Yeah, I think for me, if I can draw a line back from O-Power to my youth, it's conservation and computer science. I took a class in 11th grade in AP Pascal and loved it.
AP Pascal being a programming language.
Exactly right. It felt like you were bringing the computer to life. To be clear, I was not a hacker who spent their nights and weekends writing code all the time. But I said this is what I want to do. It's what I want to study in college, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me is, I grew up in a family where we would reuse plastic bags, and we always turned out the lights, and we barely ran the heat, and these kinds of things. It established deeply ingrained in me an aesthetic that we shouldn't be wasteful. And my mom grew up in Israel in the 50s. They had nothing, you know, and my dad grew up very poor. So I grew up with parents who had their upbringing in a totally different time and era where they were extremely conservative with things.
After college, you worked at a music startup called Echo Networks.
That's right.
From there, you then started EduSoft, which is this company focused on the public school assessments area. And Jake Himmelman was your co-founder at EduSoft, and you had known him from Harvard as well.
That's right.
What is he doing now?
Jake Himmelman has started a network of private, very, very low-cost schools in Kenya. He has, I believe, over 50,000 students now in his schools. And the schools cost less than the public schools. And they have perfect teacher attendance, and they have significantly higher student scores, and he's scaling this now across Africa.
And incidentally, you were raising money for EduSoft in 2000, so even though the story ends well, you had kind of a tumultuous beginning, at least raising money, is my assumption.
It was brutal.
I heard a story that you, when potential investors would visit, you would fill your desks in the office to make it seem like you were busier than you were. Is that
right.
True?
So we had...
Whose idea was that?
It was Jay's, of course. Jay was a magician as a kid and a vacuum cleaner salesman, and so he had all the great tricks. It was actually the first time Houghton Mifflin came to our offices. We wanted to appear bigger, and we told our friends we would buy them coffee and lunch if they would come and work out of desks and our office from 10 a.m. to noon.
Mm.
And we put phones on the desk and made it all look like we had 12 people at the company when there was only four of us. The problem was... 2 months later, the same guy came back, and we were like, what are we going to do? We got to get the same friends in.
So don't be fooled if you enter the office of O-Power. Some might be paid actors.
I can affirm we have no paid actors.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.